So thanks for being here. I just wanted to say, repeat something which I just said to Kevin and Alice, namely that our discussion yesterday was extremely fruitful. I mean, I felt that I really learned something. Certain things that I had said became clearer to me in the sense that I realized I had been unclear and that I could put some of these points differently. I'm scheduled to give a version of this talk in Göttingen at a Wittgenstein conference 2 weeks from now, is it? Yeah. Something like this. And I'm already conceiving of how I will rewrite it before that. So a great success up here in this respect. The 19th century was a disaster for the country, a period of complete political humiliation. The dynasty that had ruled for several centuries, autocratically but not much liked by the population, was in steep decline. The country was caught in a series of rebellions, deadly, poisonous, destructive. The result was that local warlords began to take over, and the worst of the story was that foreign powers began to acquire territory within the country and make it their own. The ideology that had been guiding the state was ossifying, had been seen or was being seen increasingly as defunct. At the beginning of the 20th century, a number of young intellectuals, politically motivated ones, began to look for some way of resuscitating the state and the political situation. They looked abroad and they acquired ideas from abroad and sought to kind of create a new society, a new state. More liberal, more progressive, more open to the modern world than the country had been until then. Unfortunately, the divisions in the country couldn't be overcome, eventually this movement, or very quickly this movement that had looked so hopeful, turned into a new form of military dictatorship. At that point, a new group of intellectuals decided that once again, one had to look for new ways of reorganizing society. They once again looked abroad and they acquired a new and different kind of political philosophy on which they sought to operate. They began to fight against the local warlords, in particular the one who had become dominant as a result of the initial reform movement. It took years and years to settle the resulting civil war. Eventually, the country became stabilized. After a long period of inner disturbances, the country also began to develop economically. But, I'm now getting close to the present, but at the same time, totally new challenges appeared, which once again seemed to throw the political system into doubt. A vast population that was difficult to nourish, to maintain, and also to control maybe, development that produced side effects of a horrible kind, of a horribly destructive kind, the need to open the economy to the global markets and the resulting inequalities, economic inequalities that resulted, new forms of communication that kind of seemed to undermine the system as it had been developing. So a society which seemed to have become stable once again issued into a moment where everybody, from those who feel themselves opposed to the existing regime, as well as those who support it, realized that the situation cannot last. I'm talking, of course, about China. I've been talking about the decline of the Qing dynasty, the failure of the Confucian state ideology, talked about Sun Yat-sen's attempts to bring liberal democracy to China, the transformation of that movement into the regime of Chiang Kai-shek. I've been talking about the introduction of Marxism into China by Mao Zedong and Zhou Enlai, and I've been talking about the current realities of China. Well, some of the problems of China were, of course, specific to that place, right? They were internal to the place. So the dynastic problems of China certainly were of that sort. But many of them had to do not with problems produced within the Chinese reality, but rather with what had been happening outside China. There had been a time, maybe in the 18th century, 17th century, when China was probably technologically more advanced than the West, than Europe. But that had stopped because Confucianism had turned into a doctrine that taught literary values rather than technological or scientific ones. The West also had developed weapons technologies to which the Chinese were unable to match. They had, as you know, invented black powder. They knew about the explosive power of chemicals, but they had used them mainly for peaceful purposes, not for weapons technology. The West also had developed economic strength through its technological and weapons development that allowed it, for instance, use and exploit the now conquered or occupied Chinese markets. So much of, and finally, one needs to say, of course, that the West had also produced, unlike China, which had stayed within the horizon of Confucian Buddhist thought, the West had produced a whole series of new political ideologies, namely the ideas of liberalism and democracy on the one hand, and of Marxist communism on the other. So the results were that China found itself in a situation of instability, which to a large extent was imported into the country from the West. And I want to say here that we find ourselves, whether we realize this fully, in a world, in a global situation of a very profound political and social crisis. That is not always so evident to us in the Western world, because we believe that our institutions are stable, we are relatively affluent, still affluent at least, right? And we seem to lack much of the turbulence that is characteristic of other parts of the world. But we have to see that the turbulences of, let's say, not only of modern China or Asia, but for instance of Africa as well, are of course the product effects of turbulences in the West, in the Western world and in the European world. And so I want to say, whether we see it or not, the crisis, the instabilities that are so obvious in these other parts of the world are really effects of our own political and social instability. So the point from which I start here is this idea that politics, far from being a stable factor in human life, and political structures and forms and the issues of politics being historically invariant and always the same, that history, that politics is in fact a deeply historical phenomenon. And that the forms it takes, and whether it takes any form whatsoever, or ends up in situations of chaos, or ends up in situations of complete stagnation, all these are historically contingent factors. And as a result of this, one has to see that our political situation is also not to be taken for granted at all. It is something that is up for grabs, and that there is indeed, even in our own world, in our own reality, a deeply critical moment. where does that originate in the West? And the answer is certainly it became visible in the first instance in the 19th century, just as it did in China, it also became visible in the West. Maybe the French Revolution is in some ways the first indication of this instability. But more important still, I think, historically, it turns out to be not the Great French Revolution, but the July Revolution of 1830. It was a revolution in which, first of all, the working class, French working class, had expected not only a removal of the reactionary, clerical, monarchical regime that had established itself after the Great French Revolution, but in which it also expected kind of an improvement, radical improvement, transformation of its own rather deprived social position. A period in which new factory modes of production were coming into existence, and the impoverishment of a new working class that was moving from the countryside into the cities was becoming more and more evident. And so the 1830 revolution represented for these masses of French people a moment of expectation and hope, namely that something would be transformed radically. But of course, the July Revolution was a failure. The result of this was a turning away of those activists in 1830, of the activists, turning away not only from the regime that had now emerged, but turning away from the state and ultimately from politics as well. 1830 was really the moment at which European anarchism made its first appearance as an ideology. The belief that one could not expect an improvement of the social situation by political means at all, that the state and the political structures and political processes were really obstacles to social improvement, and that the only way the social situation could be improved would be by abolishing those realities. So the end of politics, the end of the state, first of all, but the end of politics, maybe, in the name of, or through the replacement of, social action, of a voluntary cooperative kind. No gods, no rulers, right? Well, these ideas were promoted by various groups of French anarchists and utopian socialists, and they were studied in other parts of Europe. Lorenz von Stein, a German sociologist, went to Paris at this time in 1830, and he observed this, and he wrote a remarkable book called The Social Movements in France from 1830 to 1840. He wrote the book in a number of editions. The book was read in Germany, widely read in Germany. It was also read by Karl Marx, who as a result also went to Paris to study these movements, and Marxist, a scientific socialism, took off from the observations, but also from the critique of what Marx had seen there. Marx's view towards the state was ambiguous. In the Communist Manifesto, he says, he writes, that the state is really the tool of the exploitation of the workers by the dominant classes, and that as that domination fades away, as the communist revolution comes, the state too will disappear. In other writings, he seems to envisage a different kind of state, a more maybe a social democratic state. He is not as clear, not as outspoken as the anarchists were. But the anarchists certainly were. Bakunin, Kropotkin later on would repeat these lessons that they had originally, that originated in the 1830s. So when Bakunin, for instance, fought on the barricades of the 1848 revolution, he was at the same time writing to a friend saying, I'm not interested in new constitutions, a new political order. What we need is life itself, not politics. So there were also in Europe, signs that the confidence in the old structures and old traditions of politics were in question. Not by everybody, of course. Those who were succeeding and those who were governing felt that the political structures were stable and in fact could be reformed maybe, and that progress, liberal progress, democratic progress was a sign of the health and life of these institutions. That's what many of those who are now in power and who profit from the existing systems of power still believe today in the West. Right? But there were those, saying the anarchists above all, first of all, secondly, Marxist communists, and I want to say finally also to some extent liberals and libertarians who were questioning at least the old notions of the state and of authority, they all in some sense indicate that something was afoot in the old ways of thinking about politics. It's in that context that I want to talk here about Nietzsche. Because Nietzsche is for me a witness of a different kind, of a slightly later generation, of course, of the 1870s and 80s now, of this sense of disillusionment with the political realities and this idea that we need to rethink politics in the most radical fashion possible. All this is, in my mind, only the preparation of something that has happened in the 20th century, namely both the attempts to construct new kinds of regimes, communist, fascist, and so on, national socialist, but also the attempts of various political thinkers to rethink politics from the ground up. And as I said before, I'm thinking of specifically three interesting names, and there are many others today, for me would be Carl Schmitt, Hannah Arendt, and Michel Foucault. But I'm concerned here, so to say, with the antecedents of this 20th century development. Well, Nietzsche is, of course, a difficult thinker to deal with in any respect, right, because he is so difficult to grasp, to be pinned down, and his claims are often so radical. But specifically so when it comes to politics. Was he even a political philosopher at all? Well, after the Second World War, some people thought to rescue him by saying that he was really not at all concerned with politics, that this had been a great misunderstanding of those who had tried to use him for political purposes. I'm not so sure that this is the right reading. But if one takes for granted that he was in some sense a political thinker, then the conclusion might be that his political ideas are thoroughly unattractive, repulsive, maybe. Was he not in some ways as a forerunner of German Nazism? Well, that impression seems to be, however, due to a kind of distorted and selective and biased reading. He's a much more complex thinker. He certainly was not a German nationalist. At all. He was certainly not an anti-Semite. But did he not advance anti-democratic, anti-egalitarian, anti-socialist, aristocratic ideals, conceptions of politics? Yes, that's undeniable. Yes, he did. But I'm not concerned here with this question, what is his actual positive, concrete picture of how politics should come out. What I'm interested in here is, so I don't see him here as a prophet of a new world order or as the guru who tells us a standard bearer of a future politics. What I want to see him as is somebody who has, in a particularly interesting and deep way, diagnosed the situation in which he finds himself. And that diagnosis is of value even if we think that the prescriptions for he gives us for how to overcome the problematic critical situation is not going to be ours. So I begin with three Nietzschean propositions. The first of them occurs in Beyond Good and Evil. The subtitle of this book is, as you may know, maybe you don't know, is, interestingly enough, a prelude to the philosophy of the future. So he is looking ahead now. This is a really a future-oriented piece of philosophizing. And in that book he writes, one sentence I quote here, "The time for petty politics is over. Für kleine Politik. Time for petty politics is over." And then at roughly the same time, so this is 1886, at roughly the same time, in his notebooks, notes that are published in the text called The Will to Power, he writes, that's the title of my talk now, of course, "The time is coming when one will have to relearn about politics." Let me just say that Walter Kaufmann, who is a very good translator on the whole of Nietzsche, has made this sentence, this is section 960 of The Will to Power, sounds slightly different. He translated, "The time is coming when politics will have a different meaning." But the German is, "Die Zeit kommt, wo man über Politik umlernen wird." And I think that sounds somewhat different, and it's not easily translated into English. And what is being lost, in particular in Kaufmann's translation, is of course the link between umlernen und umwertung, right? Evaluation of values. That's why I talk about relearning. So the time is coming when one will have to relearn about politics, because, he says in that context, because there is now a beginning compulsion to great politics. So, beyond good and evil, small politics is now over, petty politics, and there is now a compulsion to große Politik, great politics. And in that same context, great politics, rule over the earth, are at hand. But, he adds to this, that there exists as yet, quote, a complete lack of the principles that are needed. So, a new kind of politics is coming about, a global politics, he means, among other things, here clearly, this is absolutely clear from the context, but it's great politics, a global politics, but we don't know how to conduct it. That's our problem, right? The principles are as yet missing. I ask myself here, to begin with, what provoked those predictive claims? The 1880s, if you remember, if you have lived long enough, the 1880s were in fact a period of consolidation in Europe. There wasn't great upheaval going on at all, right? The revolutionary impulses which had been there, of course, at the end of the 18th century, and then in the 1830, and then, of course, all over Europe in 1848, had really evaporated, right? And by 1886, the national aspirations of Germany and Italy had been satisfied, the two countries had been united, Europe was set on a course of prosperity, expansion, and colonial power. So where was the crisis that Nietzsche recognized? All in all, peace was in fact in sight for the next generation, for the next 30 years or so. Nietzsche was certainly not thinking of the need for a new great politics because of the minor political disturbances of the time. There was the Crimean crisis, and so there were these local events, but that's not what produced this feeling in him that we were now in this profound crisis. Thus, in Beyond Good and Evil, his eye was in fact on, he says in this context which I've quoted from, on the next century, he says, and its inevitable, quote, struggle for mastery over the whole earth, namely the 20th century as the political struggle for the mastery of the whole earth. And in his notebook, he was writing of an as yet indeterminate future of, quote, more comprehensive forms of dominion, of masters of the earth, artist tyrants even, still to come, who would employ Europe to, quote, get hold of the destinies of the earth so as to work as artists upon man himself. Man himself was to be transformed through these great political figures. Such visions were certainly not provoked by the immediate events of the 1880s, right? But what Nietzsche was talking about and what motivated him into thinking this was something quite different, namely that he believed that there was a kind of flood of nihilism rising, slowly, inexorably, as he said, in the will to power over the next two centuries. That's the horizon in which he is looking at it. But what does nihilism mean for Nietzsche here? And one often says, well, Nietzsche means by nihilism that all values are lost. We have no more values. But I think that's a mistake. In fact, Nietzsche defines nihilism, describes it in a completely different way. For instance, he writes that nihilism means that our highest values devalue themselves. Not that all values devalue themselves, but our highest values. Or nihilism is the conviction of an absolute untenability of existence when it comes to the highest values. That's what nihilism is. Nihilism is thus the loss of a hierarchy of values or an order of values, right? And with this, of their justification. It does not necessarily mean the disappearance of all values. So nihilism is not what one might call anomie. Anomie being the state in which one really doesn't have any values at all anymore. Nietzsche, in fact, says quite clearly that it's the reason why we think that nihilism is the loss of all values is that has something to do with the specific development of Christianity. That suggests this identity of nihilism. And he writes that the end of Christianity at the hand of its own morality has generated, and now I quote again, a repugnance against the falseness and mendacity of every Christian interpretation of the world of history. And this has in turn produced a rebound from God is the truth into the fanatical belief everything is false. But we should see that the latter move is an overreaction against the preceding Christian fanaticism, psychologically understandable but not inevitable. Nietzsche continues that, quote again, the untenability of one interpretation of the world upon which a tremendous amount of energy has been lavished awakens the suspicion that all interpretations of the world are false. That too doesn't mean that this suspicion is well-founded. So it's the collapse of the Christian system of beliefs, which he thinks leads person who experienced this loss of belief to conclude that now all values have disappeared. But nihilism is not that. And I think that Nietzsche makes that clear by distinguishing very sharply between what he calls active and passive nihilism. The passive nihilist is the one who has nothing to act on anymore. He has nothing will motivate him because he doesn't believe in anything anymore. He has no values anymore, and therefore he cannot act. Active nihilism, however, is a form of action in which you still act because something motivates you. You have some values, but there are no more highest values that you have. And so in some ways, the action itself has lost some of its previous significance. He says, in fact, active passive nihilism is a rarity. In fact, we will rather want nothing than not to want. What this means is, if we can't have any other values anymore, then we will want destruction, nothingness. Right? We will make that our value, because we are creatures who will always look for some value or other. Otherwise, we won't be able to act anymore. So man would rather will nothingness than not will. Now, Nietzsche thinks that nihilism, in this sense in which I have described it here, this loss of highest values, is so dangerous for two reasons. Namely, first of all, it makes the values that we retain anchorless. It gives unstable and shifting. All values are now the same. And whatever you value is equally good. It's a kind of culture of arbitrariness that evolves when you have no hierarchy or order to values. And the second thing is, because there is now no such hierarchy anymore, we are no longer capable of great achievements that require deep, long-term, unwavering commitments. I think we can see from our own culture what he may have had in mind. In our culture, of course, people are motivated by all kinds of values, but as you know, values shift with the wind, right? And even triviality itself on television is seen, or in the media, is seen as a value, right? So our values, you could say, they have all been reduced to fashions and have, as a result, no great consequence anymore. And that makes greatness, human greatness, impossible now. I think we can understand better what Nietzsche means by nihilism when we turn to politics. Nietzsche holds that the political form of nihilism is the democratic state. His conception of that state is essentially taken from Plato, from Plato's Republic. The democratic polis, Plato writes, is a place, quote, full of freedom and freedom of speech. One can do what he wants and arrange his life in whatever manner pleases him. In consequence, there will be, again Plato's words, all sorts of characters, fine and multicolored. And the polis will look like, quote, a coat embroidered with every kind of ornament. Plato's polis recognizes no order of rank between men and women, masters and slaves, nor any other distinction of rank, because it is built on the ideals of self-realization and subjective freedom. The democratic polis will also be a place of continuous turmoil, of course, and prone to disintegration. Plato's democracy has indeed come about through the decay of other, better forms of government, and is bound to give way in turn to a still worse political system, namely tyranny. A reversal will come about only when a philosopher king establishes himself and reforms the city in the light of his knowledge of a genuine order of values. Only that can bring about political reform. Modern democracy, so Nietzsche is always looking at the ancients, of course. Modern democracy, so Nietzsche, exemplifies the same tendencies as Plato's polis. It too is a place of moral and political pluralism. It too lacks distinctions of rank and instead advances liberalism and socialism, feminism and egalitarianism. It too is unstable and bound to decay. And this is what political nihilism looks like for Nietzsche, a condition from which no petty politics can relieve us. If we are to overcome political nihilism, we must establish a new hierarchy and order of values, and that means also new highest values. The great politics Nietzsche envisions will therefore call for new kinds of, these are terms he uses, masters, for new kinds of mastery, for hierarchy and an order of rank. Only in one respect does Nietzsche's conception of such a great new politics diverge from Plato's, where the latter speaks of a knowledge of the ideas and thus assigns to the man of knowledge, the philosopher, the main role in politics. Maybe he is the one who will tell us what this true order of values is. Nietzsche believes in the creative invention of values and therefore in what he calls artist tyrants, that is, artists who impose their values on us, who produce these values and then thereby make them ours. Now I want to turn, these are thoughts from the of Nietzsche from the 1880s. That's when he talks about nihilism, that's when he gives this critique of the democratic state. What I want to turn to now is as a somewhat earlier phase, in the 1870s, late 1870s, and the book called Human, All Too Human, and in particular a section called A Glance at the State. It's in that text where Nietzsche initiated his critique of modern democracy. It was in this text also that he first used the dramatic phrase, the time is coming, die Zeit kommt, because it has a kind of ominous tone to it, you know, you have to kind of hear it. Yeah. That is, the time for a new politics and a new conception of politics. He wrote that the medieval church had once aimed at being a universal institution and had sought to serve the highest interests of the whole of mankind. The states and nations of recent history presented by contrast, quote, a disheartening impression of being petty, kleinlich, mean, materialistic, and narrow in space. The states and nations of modernity were, of course, serving real needs, Nietzsche granted, whereas the politics of the church had been built on illusion. But, so Nietzsche concluded, the time is coming when institutions arise to serve the true common needs of the people. And it was at this glance at the state that Nietzsche also spoke for the first time of a great politics, großer Politik. So both this notion, die Zeit kommt, große Politik. But as it turns out, strangely enough, in this earlier text, große Politik does not have great politics, does not have yet this positive connotation that it has in the passages that I quoted from the 1880s. The new institutions Nietzsche was thinking of were certainly not those of the democratic state, whatever they were. He made that clear in the long aphorism 472, in the Glance of the State, which maps out what Nietzsche perceives to be the problem, to be problematic in modern politics. He speaks in this aphorism of the state and its moral basis, and he means by the state here, first of all, I think, the classical European state of the 17th and 18th century. So not any state, but the modern state, with its what he calls absolute tutelary government. So absolute government, tutelary government. The absolute welfare state. Right? The state that sees itself, this is a quote, a phrase again, as guardian for the benefit of the masses not yet of age. This classical state has given way in more recent times, he says, to the more precarious institutions of the democratic state, which understands itself as, quote, the instruments of the popular will, as a function of the sole sovereign power, the people, the state in which the opinion of the people must find its echo in their representatives, a state dedicated to the unshackling of the private person. In each terminology, the terms the state and the democratic state refer thus to historically specific institutions. His crucial thesis is that the modern democratic state is not a self-standing political order, but represents, quote, the historical form of the decay of the state, in the classical sense. Democracy is the historical form of the decay of the state. Nietzsche explains the transition from the tutelary to democratic government in terms of the loss of belief in God as final authority and highest value, and thereby of a general disintegration of a belief in highest values, right? And the resulting disestablishment of religion. He maintains accordingly that, quote, the interests of tutelary government and the interests of religion go hand in hand together, so that when the latter begins to die out, the foundations of the state, too, are undermined. The absolute government of the 17th and 18th century becomes impossible once the state separates itself from religion. Insofar as the death of God signals for Nietzsche the devaluation of our highest values, and according to his later formulation, the coming of nihilism, therefore, the decline of tutelary government, the rise of democracy, and the eventual decline and death of the state will turn out to be all aspects of the history of nihilism. The belief that the authority of government has and must have divine origins reflects indeed the dominant self-image of the modern absolute state. Even Hegel still holds that, quote, religion is intimately associated with the principle of the state. Don't give you an idea. Religion is needed, so Nietzsche writes cynically, to reconcile the masses to inevitable evils the state cannot or will not prevent, and to reconcile them to shortcomings of the state government or the perilous consequences of domestic interests. This may be true, however, only for the European tradition. I'll keep a few words here. In the Western tradition, so Nietzsche anyway, the modern absolute state is eventually challenged by the democratic state, in which, quote, a quite different conception of government prevails. But he considers this new political order to be inherently unstable. For this, he can draw not only on Plato's opinion, but also on the actual history of Greek democracy, of course, and various later attempts, for instance, in the Renaissance, to realize some form of democratic government. But is there an inherent tendency in democracy to dissolution? That Nietzsche tries to argue on philosophical grounds. He identifies, in any case, three successive states of disregard, decline, and ultimate death of the state as, quote, the consequence of the democratic conception of the state. And he adds to this the sharp judgment that it is indeed in this that the mission of the democratic state lies. The mission of the democratic state is its own destruction. That's the reason. The privatization of religion marks, according to Nietzsche, the first stage in this dissolution of the state. The development is initiated by the splintering of the Christian church into various factions during the Reformation. Next comes the moment in the Enlightenment where the people governing the absolute state begin to feel superior to religion. Think of somebody like Hume. Once that attitude spreads, quote, an employment and exploitation of the religious drives and consolations for political ends will no longer be easy, and the privatization of religion will get on its way. While we tend to regard this process of privatization today as a decisive advance in individual freedom, and thus in the rights of the individual, Nietzsche is far less sanguine about it. Its first consequence is for him, quote, an apparent strengthening of religious feelings. Freed from political constraints, religious feelings can now seek new outlets. This leads to religious excesses and extremes, so that the established forms of religion will eventually be overrun by sects. It then becomes evident that, quote, at the moment religion was made a private affair, an abundance of dragon's teeth were sown. Now it is far from obvious that religious extremism is a consequence only of a privatized religion, for we know only too well of the religious frenzy absolute rulers are capable of. But it is certainly true that the privatization of religion in the West has led to repeated waves of religious reawakenings since the Victorian age, and to a proliferation of new denominations in the same period, from Mormonism through the old Catholics to the panoply of evangelical churches and mini churches and various spiritual churches and movements. So I think in that sense Nietzsche is right in saying the privatization of religion brings about this multiplication of religion and religious fervor. Nietzsche predicts further what is also confirmed by our experience, that such an intensification of religious feelings will in turn bring about a backlash in which, quote, every better and better gifted man will make irreligion his private affair. And these sentiments may in turn generate, quote, an almost fanatical enthusiasm for the state. So on the one hand, you have religious obsession developing as a result of privatization of religion. On the other hand, irreligion, and that now being replaced by or being supplemented by enthusiasm, fanatical enthusiasm for the state, filling the emotional void formerly occupied by religion with, quote, a kind of substitute in the form of devotion to the state. He considers, moreover, certain that with the spread of such sentiments, governments will give their measures increasingly a character hostile to religion. And that will in turn provoke a backlash from the religious, who now become decidedly hostile to the state. This dialectic is indeed thoroughly familiar to us from recent history, where fundamentalist sectarianism, a-religiousness, the state's hostility to religion and religion's hostility to the state, as well as the extreme worship of the state in various forms of fascist ideology, are all found jostling together. For Nietzsche, the history of the modern and democratic state involves thus a struggle between the religious and the anti-religious parties, whose outcome he considers by no means predictable. He offers us thus an alternative to Max Weber's thesis that modern society is engaged in an inevitable process of secularization. In Nietzsche's picture, the disestablishment of religion will have as one of its side products a new intensification of religious feeling among some people, and in the resulting struggle between the religious and the anti-religious, the latter may even win out, re-establishing a religious despotism, quote, perhaps less enlightened and more troubled by fear than formerly. Another possible outcome is, of course, that the anti-religious parties succeed once and for all in undermining the propagation of their opponents. These possibilities are again familiar to us from contemporary politics, with some societies turning back towards a clerical regime, think of contemporary Iran, others maintaining a consciously secularist and anti-religious stance, think of China, and yet others, like the United States, experiencing a continuous vicious battle between the religious and the anti-religious parties. While Nietzsche declares himself uncertain about the ultimate outcome of this struggle, he is sure the cause of this development, the underlying principle of the democratic state, will be more and more exposed. It will become clear then that this state is based on a single-minded commitment to the freedom of the individual. When this becomes finally apparent, the individual will respect only that side of the state which, quote, promises to be useful or threatens to be harmful for him, and will bend all his efforts to acquiring influence upon it. Like Plato in the Republic, Nietzsche assumes that the desire for political self-determination will eventually give way to unconstrained selfishness, and that the first result of this will be sharply increased competition. He writes, and now comes a longer quote, but this competition will soon become too great, and parties alternate too quickly, hurl one another too fiercely down the hill after barely having attained the top. None of the measures affected by a government will be guaranteed continuity. Everyone will draw back from undertakings that require quiet tending for decades or centuries if their fruit are too mature. No one will feel towards the law any greater obligation than that of bowing for the moment to the force which backs up the law. One will then at once set to work to subvert it with a new force, the creation of a new majority. Once again, it is easy to identify aspects of our own political reality that fit these characterizations. Nietzsche goes on to argue that at this stage, quote, distrust of all government will initiate, quote, the resolve to do away with the concept of the state, and dissolve in particular the distinction between the private and the public. When the state is ruled entirely by private interests, its functions will be taken over more and more by those who seek to make private profit from this. He writes, private companies will step by step absorb the business of the state. Even the most resistant remainder of what was formerly the work of government, for example, its activities to protect the private person from the private person, will in the long run be taken care of by private contractors. Once more, we are reminded of our own political reality, with its private security firms, private armies, private prisons, and the whole-scale privatizations of services formerly performed by the state. Nietzsche is convinced that the process will reach its logical end in the disintegration of the entire political order, and that at that point, quote, a new page will be turned in the storybook of humanity. But he is not at all keen to see this day too soon. He puts his trust modestly instead, this is the moderate middle period Nietzsche, he puts his trust modestly instead, quote, in the prudence and self-interest of men to preserve the existing state for some time yet and to repulse the destructive experiment of the precipitate and the overzealous. At the same time, he reflects on what is likely to happen after the disappearance of the state. And here he is sure that, quote, the last that will ensue is chaos. Instead, we will see the appearance of new forms of political order. Quote, an invention more suited than the state was will gain victory over the state. For the state as we know it is only a specific historical creation and as such contingent. Nietzsche reminds us at this point of the existence of other earlier forms of political order. Quote, for example, that of the racial clan, which was for millennia far mightier than that of the family, and indeed ruled and regulated long before the family existed. Subsequently, the ideal of familial rights and power came to rule, quote, as far as the Roman world extended. But it has since grown ever paler and more impotent. Nietzsche is sure that later generations, quote, will see the state too shrink to insignificance in various parts of the world, a notion many people of the present can hardly contemplate without fear or revulsion. He is clear, however, on two things. The first is that one has to work actively for the abolition of nations. European nationalism is an anathema to him and the cause of many of Europe's troubles, and he is not afraid to proclaim himself, therefore, a good European rather than a German. and he becomes thus the first European philosopher to do so. European integration seems to him indeed inevitable, given, quote, trade and industry, the post and the book trade, the possession in common of all higher culture, rapid changing of homes and scene, and so on and so on. He believes furthermore that this integration has to be accompanied by a mixing of the European nations, the achievement of a European racial union, and that is too is already underway, he thinks. He hopes that this process will at once solve the notorious problem of anti-Semitism, since, quote, the entire problem of the Jews exists only within nation states. The Jews with their exceptional talents would indeed be important for, quote, the production of the strongest possible European mixed race. Nietzsche offers us at this point his most positive assessment of the Jews, who have had, quote, the most grief-laden history of any people, for which he adds, all of us are not without blame. We have to thank the Jews, he writes, for the noblest human being in Christ, the purest sage in Spinoza, and the mightiest book and the most efficacious moral code in the world. Jewish scholars helped, moreover, in the darkest period of the Middle Ages, quote, to uphold the banner of enlightenment and intellectual independence. They restored our link to the ancient world, and it is thanks to them, quote, that a more natural, rational, and in any event, unmythical elucidation of the world could at last obtain victory. End of quote. His hopes, we can see now, were of course overly optimistic. Europe is still struggling to unite itself. Nationalism, European and otherwise, has yet to be overcome. A mingling of the European races is still hard to conceive. What we have as a European Union is so far only a business arrangement. There is no philosophical vision of Europe. Nietzsche has found few successors in his efforts to be a good European. The problem of anti-Semitism still persists. The more rabid persecution of the Jews since Nietzsche's time, sometimes conducted even absurdly enough in the name of Nietzsche, has moreover weakened the capacity of the Jews, envisaged by Nietzsche, to serve as a bond across races and nationalities, and has given impetus instead to a new Jewish nationalism with all its attendant problems and perplexities. In addition, the Europeans have invented new forms of discrimination directed against new minorities. Nietzsche's vision, in other words, has yet to be realized and may indeed turn out to be incapable of being fully implemented, given that the process of European unification, which he envisaged, has already been caught up in the swell of globalization. Nietzsche's belief that a unified Europe might be able to make itself the master of the earth is surely already disproven. Even so, the Europeans may still have to reach up for some of Nietzsche's vision if they are to maintain themselves economically, politically, in the emerging struggle for global power. I've occupied myself so far with only one or two aphorisms of Nietzsche's glance at the state. I'll finish in a few moments. A broader look at that section is, however, in place, since it will both confirm and modify what I've said so far. Nietzsche begins his glance at the state with a critique of the democratic state, which is always in his everything he lost is lost. He quotes Voltaire, when the populace joins into the reasoning. Wonderful sentence. Everything's lost when the populace joins into the reasoning. I didn't know that Voltaire said this. And that has happened in the democratic states, which, quote, aims to make life endurable for as many as possible. The people in this state want for once to forge for themselves their own fortunes and misfortunes. That is not objectionable, Nietzsche argues, as long as this narrow-mindedness does not go so far as to demand that everything should become politics in this sense, that everyone should live and work according to such a standard. At least a few must be allowed to refrain from this sort of egalitarian politics and to step a little aside, he says. These few will fail to take the happiness of the many so seriously, whether by the many one understands nations or social classes. For they know that a higher culture can come about only where there are different castes, a distinction of rank, and thus also an order and hierarchy of values. Nietzsche is in fact convinced that the distinction of rank underlies every stable political order. In the classical form of the state, men treat their princes as if they were gods, he writes, or at least as representatives of God. And quote, wherever there is a striving to exalt individual man into something superhuman, there also appears the tendency to imagine whole classes of people as being coarser and lower than they really are. Princely rule and class division thus go hand in hand. The distinction of rank generates the kind of willingness to subordinate, quote, which is so highly rated in the military and bureaucratic state. In the democratic state, on the other hand, subordination is no longer valued and must therefore become unbelievable. Quote, it is bound to disappear because its foundations are disappearing. Belief in unconditional authority, in definite truth. In freer, that is, more egalitarian and more democratic circumstances, people subordinate themselves only conditionally as the result of a mutual contract, and thus without prejudice to their self-interest. But we must recognize that, quote, a host of the most astonishing operations will no longer be possible when subordination ceases to be acceptable. Nietzsche is certain that our political order will therefore eventually disintegrate, just as, quote, all previous orders have done, so as soon as the suns of novel opinions shine out over mankind with a new heat. But once again, he is cautious about this possibility and adds that one can wish for the dissolution of the existing political order only if one harbors hope. And this hope is usually just, quote, a piece of presumption and overvaluation. It is, however, not only the state that is undermined, where the sense of subordination is lost. Great culture also ceases to be possible, he goes on to argue. With the introduction of this theme opens up a new line of thought whose implications become most evident in the next to last aphorism of the section on the state and human, all too human. It is in this aphorism also that he introduces the concept of a great politics. That term was by no means Nietzsche's invention. It was in fact a common term of the period. People were talking about great politics, and the great politics was typically seen as being foreign politics. This is Großepolitik, means not home politics, but foreign politics, particularly, of course, conquest, wars, colonial, imperialism, whatever. That kind of politics, Nietzsche said, was characteristic not only of the classical modern state, but even more so of the democratic state, which squanders away, quote, men of the highest civilization in its conscription armies. The Nietzsche of human, all too human, expresses a profound distaste for this sort of great politics. Evidently still under the impact of the 1870-71 war against France, in which he had served, he writes, quote, against war, it can be said, it makes the victor, as in this case the Germans, stupid, the defeated, in this case the French, malicious. War, he adds, makes people more barbaric, and in that state they find themselves, quote, in the winter or hibernation of culture. There is a higher mission to be found in culture than in fatherland and honor, and, quote, a crude Roman patriotism is either something dishonest or a sign of retardation. These thoughts are brought to a point in aphorism 481, where Nietzsche argues that, quote, every efficient, industrious, intelligent, energetic man who belongs to a people lusting after a great politics will be consumed by that lust because he no longer can belong to his own domain. The greatest cost of great politics in this sense is indeed that it removes an extraordinary number of its efficient and industrious men from their proper professions and occupations. The result will be almost necessarily a spiritual impoverishment and enfeeblement and a diminution of the capacity for undertaking demanding great concentration and application. There manifests itself here, so Nietzsche, a profound antagonism between politics and the demands of culture. Even the Greek polis, he writes, was mistrustful of the growth of culture and sought almost exclusively to paralyze and to inhibit it. There is no reason to subscribe to the grand optimistic illusion of a Pericles concerning a natural link between Athenian culture and the democratic polis. In reality, this culture evolved in spite of the polis. Far from celebrating a great new politics, we should thus realize that it is usually on the political sickbed where a nation, quote, rejuvenates itself and rediscovers its spirit, which it gradually lost in its seeking for an assertion of power. Culture owes the most to the ages of political weakness. With this in mind, I can turn back finally now to the Nietzsche of 1886 and his very different assessment of the value of a great politics, where he had seen an irreconcilable conflict between politics and culture, in human all too human. The Nietzsche of Beyond Good and Evil was willing to concede the possibility of their reconciliation. This new form of great politics was to be the work of exceptional men, producing entirely new values, new hierarchies and orders of value, not that of ordinary politicians. It was to be a great European cultural politics, not the power politics of the old European nation states. A politics of a newly united Europe and of a great artist dedicated to carrying out at once the work of culture and politics, not a politics of senseless, crude, barbaric, and nationalistic warfare. I've had enough time here. I have another section which is about Hegel and Marx, and saying, of course, you should understand that clearly he puts himself in stark contrast to Hegel with his elevation of the state as the place in which the individual finds his fulfillment. On the other hand, he also clearly puts himself in contrast to Marx here and other radicals with their doubts about politics. So he wants to have politics, but a politics beyond the state and a completely new kind of politics. Hence, we need to relearn what politics is all about. Okay, thank you.